from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look at protest safety ahead of May Day marches in Milwaukee and across the country. Then we'll learn about Sharon Dixon, a local LGBTQ pioneer whose support of women and their night spots spans nearly six decades.
It's our community that Sharon has taken care of the most. So our idea was to step up and, really pull people together whose lives have been touched by Sharon in some way and really allow them to say thank you.
Plus, we'll look at what Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail has to offer hikers and backpackers.
The Ice Age Trail can provide a national park-like experience. And within just a couple hours drive, honestly, it's an amazing trail and it's an amazing thing to explore.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Tomorrow, May 1st, there will be national protests in support of immigrant and workers' rights. In Milwaukee, Voces de la Frontera is the lead organizer of the May Day March and A Day Without Immigrants. The Trump administration's mass deportation efforts have changed things for May Day marchers. So how safe is it for people with vulnerable status to take to the streets? That's the question WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez asks in this edition of The Check-In, Voices from Milwaukee's Changing Immigrant Landscape. He's joined by Fernanda Jimenez, a founding member of the immigrant advocacy group Comité Sin Fronteras, along with attorney Rich Sachs.
Rich, I just want to start with you thinking about the marches tomorrow. What should people know, specifically those who their status may be vulnerable and maybe afraid to be in a public space, know before they march?
Well, there's several things to know. And the first thing that's most important that everybody should be aware of, regardless of your status, is that the Constitution of the United States, and especially the First Amendment right to free expression, applies to all human beings who are currently in the United States, regardless of your immigration status. The constitutional protections to free speech, the right to assembly, all those rights are protected and insured for all individuals living in the United States who want to participate tomorrow in the May Day March. We see what's going on in the country is that what is constitutionally protected theoretically doesn't always play out or is not always respected by the current administration. So we say to everybody that there's safety in numbers in participating in a march. We will have legal observers and attorneys at the march to help if there's any issues. Historically, these marches have been peaceful. They've been family friendly for over a dozen years. So we want everybody, the entire community, to turn out for May Day.
How can folks stay safe in the future if they're marching at an event that doesn't have, let's say, a Rich Sachs or legal observers or anything like that? Or should they even be marching?
We can't predict what ICE is going to do, what federal law enforcement is going to do at any protest or any march, and we have to always be prepared. So there's no guarantee of absolute safety, of absolute guarantees of democratic rights, absolute guarantees of your security. But the times that we're in, the issues that people face are so important that we have to find ways to stand up and we have to overcome our fears. We have to overcome those concerns and stand up for the future for our children and the people that will follow behind us so we can preserve democracy and we can preserve the right of people to come to the United States and build new lives for their families.
Fernanda, I want to jump over to you because I know you're in constant conversation with folks mixed status or undocumented or whatever the case may be. When it comes to something like the marches tomorrow or the marches that have been happening over the past week, what are you hearing from people? Like, what are the concerns that you're hearing from community members?
So most of my community that's in mixed status is undocumented, documented, or adjusting status have been expressing to us of the fear of coming out to May Day, coming out to a march. And I think it's that they have a feeling for some reason, and it's a valid reason, that if they put themselves out there in a march and they have their faces out, pictures are being taken of them. There could be potential ICE presence at marches like this. So a lot of them are, while we're inviting them to May Day, are asking, like, is it safe for me? Is it safe for my parents, who are more vulnerable because they're fully undocumented? All those questions. And we've addressed it to them that, like Rich Sacks had said, May Day isn't just a day of action in Wisconsin. It's an international day of action, and it has been historically safe. And we have people who are trained to legally observe, protect the community who is marching that day. It is very, very family friendly. So we invite them to bring their kids, anyone who's part of their family, neighborhoods, friends, to come out to May Day. And we've told them that we know that you're safer in community with us. As an undocumented immigrant, as well with parents with different immigration statuses, I have always felt safe with my community, with my comrades, with Voces, with Comité Sin Fronteras, because they are trained and they have been doing this work for years. So it's a place where you will be safe.
I think something that can be difficult for folks right now in this moment is that there's so much information coming at them. False reporting or ICE sightings within Milwaukee that travel on social media at light speed, it feels like, but also the unpredictability of ICE that actually in Milwaukee. How do you and how are you combating misinformation or lack of information, and how are you planning on that before an event like the May Day marches?
Some of the work that we've been doing at Voces and Comité Sin Fronteras is training people on how to verify ICE. And we actually just did a training recently on training everyone and anyone who is part of the communities to know what to look for if you do see ICE presence, what to do to debunk if people are saying it is ICE, to always record, to be confident in knowing your rights. So before these marches, it's really about informing the communities on what that looks like, training them on how to verify them, and then also having community presence of other people who are not maybe undocumented or in that different immigration status, but are citizens and who have more confidence to be able to, you know, stand there with us. I think our community is growing, not just in Milwaukee. I'd say Racine as well, other areas in Wisconsin, and we're still working on getting our community base bigger.
As people take to the streets, you know, I know there have been like Know Your Rights training hosted by Voces and other events like that. I'm curious if you have a basic checklist for folks to think about or keep in mind as they take to the streets, how they can keep themselves safe in a moment like this if they are interested in marching.
The most important things are to be with people who you know. If you're coming by yourself, try to hook up and stay near and with other folks that you may know or can talk to. So if something does happen in the march, there's other people there who can see what happened and who can also support each other. The other thing that we always say is very important is that we'll have marshals throughout the march at every step, and listen to the marshals. Someone who doesn't listen to the marshals is just inviting trouble into the march. So listen to the marshals. And those are the two most important things that we would tell people.
Fernanda, I was curious for you, if you have any like final messages for people before they head out into the streets tomorrow and then moving forward as well.
I think that what's so important is that we don't feed into the fear in our communities. And for DACA recipients and our parents and all those in mixed status families, we have made it clear to all of our people that we cannot win anything if we stay in the shadows and we continue to stay in the shadows. If we take any step back, we're going to stay back. And that's why it's so critical for everyone to come out to march, not just on May Day, but to continue to coming out to our next marches, our meetings, to stay informed, to know your rights, and to be able to provide that information to the other people that you know. The more that we can give all of this information to be in community, the better it is for everyone. So please don't be in the shadows. Please come out to May Day. Please come to meetings. You're safer in numbers. You're safer in our communities. So please come out. And I also want to let people know that something we've been telling everyone is if you can't drive to, if you're from other areas of Wisconsin and you want to come out to May Day, we do have buses coming from different cities in Wisconsin. And if you are looking to come out to May Day and you don't have a ride, and it's also safer when you come with a group of people. I think it's always safer if you come out with the bus. So I can say the number where you can call that will direct you, whoever answers that call, they will direct you to the exact city that you're at with the exact organizer that will connect you to the bus so that you can RSVP your seat and you can guarantee yourself a spot to come out to May Day. So if you are looking to come out to May Day and you want to have a ride, please call the Voces number. It is 414-643-1620.
I would just want to add one thing for people. Fernanda mentioned that May Day is a International Workers' Day. But what a lot of people don't know is that May Day started in the United States, in Chicago, to commemorate the martyrs, the Haymarket martyrs from the 1880s, who got shot and killed fighting for the 8-hour day. And we have those folks to thank for the fact that we have an 8-hour day in the United States. So May Day has always been an important holiday for working people, including immigrants, immigrant workers. And workers had to stand up in the 19th century just to get the 8-hour day. And today we want to continue that tradition and stand up and fight for freedom and security in the United States for all immigrants who are working in the United States.
Just be there May 1st at 9:30 a.m., 8th and Mitchell.
Be there or be square.
That's right.
All right. Thank you, Fernanda and Rich, so much for chatting with me.
Thank you.
That was Comité Sin Fronteras founder Fernanda Jimenez and attorney Rich Sachs. They both spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 20 minutes, we'll learn about Milwaukee's geological architecture. But first, we'll learn about Sharon Dixon, a local LGBTQ pioneer whose support of women and their night spots spans nearly 6 decades. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Bars play an important role for the local LGBTQ community, serving as a gathering place for safety and understanding. Bouncer, bartender, businesswoman, and community advocate Sharon Dixon has played a major part in Milwaukee's LGBTQ history. Throughout her career, she's been involved with nearly every woman's bar in town. After decades of serving her community, Dixon was recently in need of their support in return. Last month, a fundraiser was held in Walker's Point in honor of Dixon and her legacy in the LGBTQ community. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski has that story.
In 1975, Sharon Dixon, along with her partner Joanne Kilsdonk, were the first women in Milwaukee to open a bar that was, quote, owned and operated by and for women. It was called the Sugar Shack, and it was the start of Dixon's career of not just being a bar owner, but a community protector who helped countless people in times of need. Michael Dakosh, chair of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project, explains Dixon's legacy.
So Sharon Dixon is really quite a pioneer in the Wisconsin LGBTQ history scene. For over 5 decades, for almost 3 generations, Sharon has been part of the community as a friend, as a business owner, as a champion, as a protector, as somebody who created spaces for women by women, which is an important distinction. for many, many years, you know, there were lesbian bars or places that welcomed or in even earlier years tolerated lesbians. But Sharon saw a need and a need to be the difference. She knew that most of the bars that women were allowed to attend were owned by straight people. And those straight people were there to make money off the community. They weren't there to create a great experience. They weren't there to create a community. They really didn't care much about their customers. So Sharon saw a real need. She saw a need for spaces that understood women, that would create a community of women, and she set forth a plan in motion to own and open her first bar in 1975, and that really changed everything. There was nothing like it.
Women would travel from all over Wisconsin and even out of state to visit Dixon's bar, the Sugar Shack. Before she became a community figure here in Milwaukee, Dixon grew up in Hurley, Wisconsin. According to Takash, she was having problems at home and decided it was time to leave and wound up hitchhiking to Milwaukee.
Now, keep in mind, she was 14 at the time. So at 14, Sharon was a homeless youth, very much like youth of today, you know, leaving home because they were not understood, not welcomed, not supported. And, I mean, she spent a lot of time in gas station bathrooms. She would, you know, go in the bathroom, the guys would close the station for the night, and she'd have a safe and warm place to sleep and somehow made it survive. She would stay in downtown movie theaters that were open 24 hours.
Dixon lived around the city and worked various jobs in Milwaukee until she got a cross-country sales job at just 17 years old.
Eventually, she did see all 48 states and basically went from, you know, coast to coast with this job. And that's really where she became aware of, you know, her sexual identity and who she really was.
Resourcefulness, grit, determination, all of these qualities are true to Dixon. In addition to the co-founding of the Sugar Shack, Dixon also ran Fanny's, Kathy's Nut Hut, and Studio 200 throughout the Milwaukee area. Diane Gregory, board member of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project and a local performer also known as Legs, shares what Dixon's bars were like.
Her place... Well, we always know we would see somebody that we knew. And it was just a whole different kind of a vibe because all women, mostly giggling, laughing. It was a club. You know, somewhere to know that you knew when you walked in, you'd see somebody you knew. She had softball teams. And I'm not sure when Sugar Shack closed, but then she opened Fanny's. And that's where everything happened. Wonderful dance floor. It was a great bar. The patio I've heard talk about. She did Fanny Fest every year and raised money for AIDS, which was pretty neat, outside. She did a lot of things for the community. It's given us a safe place. When Michael said about protector, she really was. You'd go into Fanny's and she'd be at the corner of the bar, and she'd be watching her people. You know what I mean? Her ladies. And I did end up working for her at Studio 200 when it turned into a techno bar. And, you know, she lost a lot of her regular customers, like, what's going on there? But, again, I give her credit. She gave these young people a venue, and they came from all over.
Michael Takash says Dixon's role of being a protector goes all the way back to 1971 when she came back to Milwaukee.
She was a bouncer at the River Queen, which was a very popular bar, very hip and happening, that actually put some of the most popular gay bars of the 60s right out of business because it was so popular. And as a bouncer there, she really protected people, you know, from police harassment, from people harassing them on the street. She really took that job very seriously, and that is a job I think she's had ever since.
Part of Dixon's motivation to open her own bar was to change what she experienced as a bouncer, bartender, and cook in local LGBTQ bars. While they catered to the community, they were owned by straight people. And Takash notes that most owners did not look out for their customers the way Dixon did at her establishments.
No one was looking out for the women in these bars. They were just looking to make sure the women were spending money. And, you know, women didn't have as much money because they had, in some cases, children. Women made less money because there were not as many equal rights protections in the workplace. So people thought Sharon was crazy when she opened a bar for women because, you know, women don't have any money. What are you doing? But she saw the need and she felt it was really, really important.
In addition to giving people a safe space to enjoy dancing and being in community, Dixon also got involved in philanthropy. helping people both through big fundraisers and also in smaller ways, such as leaving gift baskets on people's porches who are in need of extra support.
You know, she took this commitment seriously. She raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for AIDS, cancer, LGBT causes, as well as individuals in need of care. So her idea was that everyone supported her right from the start, so she was going to support everyone around her. And that's something that she just kept on doing as long as she was able.
Jessica Fenner is the founder of Apart Music and a friend of Dixon. They met when Dixon owned Studio 200, working together on a weekly basis to put on events for the electronic music community.
At the time, there's sort of a rotation where we look for a home in Milwaukee. What is the venue going to be that welcomes what we call the underground and is interested in giving a home for that? And Studio 200 became that place very quickly. Historically, house and techno music was born out of the gay and black communities in Chicago and Detroit. And so although we are the music community, there's still a very strong connection there. And I think a very strong connection in attitude, right? The welcome and the sort of protectiveness and defender of being different, living out loud, being safe, that Sharon gave to the LGBTQIA plus community is also what she gave to the music community. And so our relationship really flourished given that approach. So although the music was completely foreign to her, she showed a great fondness for the people.
The COVID-19 pandemic clearly had a massive impact on local bars and at-risk populations. Fenner says she was concerned about Dixon being isolated, being more elderly, and not as tech savvy to be able to access support networks. So she and some friends made a point to keep in touch with Dixon.
Melody and I and a couple of others really made a point to keep in touch with her. And we developed that side of the relationship a lot more during COVID. And shortly after COVID, 2022, I had moved to Chicago that fall and then heard from Mel and Sharon that she had been receiving eviction notices for Studio 200. And, you know, there's more to that story that I won't get into, but the end result was basically that someone she had trusted on a business level had unknowingly to her had her sign over the property, and she found herself evicted from the property. She didn't know she was no longer the owner. And early in 23, she received that notice that she was had to vacate. And Sharon, you know, part of her fighting spirit that was described that made her survive as a teen and build her life the way she has means there's a certain amount of pride there and self-reliance and resilience that makes it tough to ask for help.
Losing Studio 200 also meant that Dixon lost her home that was above the club. Fenner says Dixon was determined to handle the situation on her own and was staying in hotels using her savings as well as a period in a shelter while Fenner and others were trying to help find more permanent and safe housing for Dixon.
There were a lot of challenges. And so Sharon was staying in these cheaper hotels and motels for far longer than expected. Funds, of course, diminished. And hey, I've been on the streets when I was 14, 15, 16. I can do this again, I think was the attitude that came up for her.
Fenner stayed in touch with Dixon on the phone and visited her every month as she could. Eventually, Fenner discovered that Dixon was completely unhoused full-time and had clearly been through some trauma.
It was tough. It was a really tough situation. She was absolutely destitute. She had all her belongings on her walking frame. She had declined just from what she was experiencing. Luckily, social services was able to kick into overdrive. And about 10 days later, Sharon was in housing, thank goodness. But she had been unhoused for a good 4 or 5 months overall. And so you can imagine what that does to a person. And then after some time of her having a chance to get her feet under her, that housing was also sold, and we went back onto this treadmill of needing to find her a new place, but luckily we're able to do that pretty quickly as well. And then visiting her in her new place 2 weeks later for Thanksgiving, she finally felt comfortable enough for us to be public about what she had been going through.
After Thanksgiving, Fenner and others began a GoFundMe campaign for Dixon to help raise funds to help her reestablish not just a home, but her quality of life. Last month, hundreds of community members came together for Remember When, a tribute to Sharon Dixon at Lacage in Walker's Point. Michael Takash of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project shares what motivated them to organize a public tribute for Dixon.
So the History Project, you know, really was inspired by the fundraiser that Jessica and Melody had put together and thought, you know, this is a community taking care of Sharon, but it's our community that Sharon has taken care of the most. So our idea was to step up and, you know, really pull people together whose lives have been touched by Sharon in some way and really allow them to say thank you.
The afternoon was filled with open mic tributes, drag performances, and more in celebration of a woman who's helped shape Wisconsin LGBTQ history. The fundraiser marked the end of Women's History Month, but more importantly honored Dixon's legacy of creating safe spaces.
She did everything the old-fashioned way. Blood, sweat, and tears. She didn't give birth to any children, but look around because we are her children. Because of Sharon and other wonderful women and men alike, they knocked down the doors and the walls and made paths for all of us to walk. So it was safe for us to go out. It was safe for us to meet. It was safe for us to party. And now everybody is so used to it and they think it's so commonplace, they all take it for granted. It wasn't always an easy way. But today we gather and we're able to say a unified, gathered thank you.
I caught up with Sharon Dixon briefly at her celebration between the many tributes, both on mic and from fans coming up to her on the dance floor. She says being able to create safe spaces for her community will always be her biggest accomplishment.
I prided myself on the fact that I tried my very best to make sure that they were always safe. Women at that time still needed a place to go where they could still be themselves. But I ruffled a few feathers. One of my first business cards said a place owned and operated by women for women. And some of the gay guys took it funny, but they got over it. I always wanted to help people if I could, but the women's community, whether it be gay or straight, it just, they all needed a safe place to go. Yeah, where they would be treated right. And it had to be done. It was the right time.
What does it mean to you to see all of them here today and some of your old bar patrons coming here to celebrate you?
That was heartfelt. I didn't expect such a big turnout. And I'm glad I showed up.
So how does it feel to be able to accept help from the people you've helped in the past and other people you've perhaps never met but are inspired by you?
Well, I'm somewhat embarrassed, but I'm also very pleased that so many showed up, and that's all I can really say. I was fortunate.
Dixon says she's enjoyed everything she got to do and gained a lot of respect out of it from all the women in the community. And in turn, the community showed up for her. They returned the favor of providing a safe haven to someone who provided that to them for decades.
Raised! Now this is all going, and it's all real, we checked. None of it was counterfeit. $2,600! That's a lot of love. For you, my dear, because that's how loved you are. To Sharon Dixon.
For Lake Effect, I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
because it only serves to make me more determined to achieve my final goal. And I come back even stronger, not a novice any longer, cause you deepen the conviction in my soul. Oh yes, I'm wise, but it's wisdom born of pain. Yes, I pay the price.
You've probably heard of Cream City Brick, but how about Wauwatosa Dolostone, Crossvale Sandstone, or Larvikite Monzonite? While not receiving the same notoriety as Cream City Bricks, these types of stones are found in buildings throughout Milwaukee. Raymond Wiggers is a geologist, science writer, and author of the book Milwaukee in Stone and Clay, which chronicles dozens of different types of rocks that buildings in our city are made of, and how they got here. He joins Lake Effect Sam Woods to talk about the book and his longtime interest in Milwaukee's architectural geology.
Before we get into the book, I want to know more about your background and your connection to Milwaukee.
Sure. Well, actually, I am a person who grew up about halfway between Milwaukee and Chicago. So I always had this kind of bipolar idea of what a city should be. I had Milwaukee on one side. My family often went to Milwaukee. We often went to Chicago. My dad worked in Chicago. And so those were the two great cities of my life up through about the time I was in high school. And I had always been interested both in architecture and in geology, a little bit more so in geology. So when I went to college at Purdue University, I got my degree in geology. And then in the many years since then, I have gotten more and more into the field, not only of professional geology, but also into the world of science writing. And I've done a number of books, several books now in primarily the fields of geology. And after in the late 90s, I came out with a book on the geology, the general geology of Illinois. And in that book, there was one chapter on the architectural geology of Chicago. And that was actually the most popular chapter in the entire book. I started this research program over the entire area, back to my childhood haunts in Milwaukee, going up as far as Door County, going all the way over to Montello and Portage and Baraboo. And I started the series. In fact, I after teaching college for about 20 years, I retired and started the series on architectural geology.
Tell me about your research process for this book, because right now I'm imagining you going block to block, revisiting those old childhood haunts in Milwaukee and seeing them through new eyes. But I'm guessing there was a little bit more to your research process than just visiting old buildings you remembered.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. That's what the geologists call the field work. So that's where you're actually, walking around, actually looking at what we call, the rock outcrop or the exposure. In this case, it's a building that has this wonderful rock, or it has this geologically derived clay or terracotta or metal on it. And that's part of the process. And certainly talking to people, talking to the building managers, talking to the architects who designed it. I've had some wonderful conversations with architects, for example, who designed 100 East, the Faison building over by the river on Wisconsin Avenue. And you get a lot of wonderful perspective from people who were actually part of the construction process. But we also are dealing with buildings that were built in 1870, 1861, and so on and so forth. So you really have to delve into the historical record and look at the, as historians call them, the primary sources, which involve looking at a lot of trade journals, a lot of newspaper articles. One of my favorite subjects in the book was the great mythic Lake Emily that's supposedly under the Northwestern Mutual building. And I found a wonderful journal Sentinel. It was the Milwaukee Sentinel in those days. It was the Milwaukee Sentinel writing this wonderful historical analysis of Lake Emily when it still existed. So you have to dig into the, into the archives. I spent a lot of time, for example, at the Milwaukee County Historical Society archives, and people there were very helpful. A lot of time at the Milwaukee Public Library. So it's been a mixture, but yes, a lot of time on the ground, actually looking and analyzing the materials right in front of you.
When I think of architecture in Milwaukee, my mind immediately goes to Cream City Bricks. Cream City Bricks, they have an established association with Milwaukee as a common building material, and of course, even contribute to one of the city's nicknames, the Cream City. And while you see a lot of instances of buildings that use Cream City brick that are included in this book, many of them contain materials other than Cream City brick. And I'm curious, is it possible to draw conclusions about the economic history of the city from the building materials used? Like, for example, if a building is made primarily of materials sourced from outside the Midwest, is it fair to assume that the original owner of the building was wealthier than the owner of a building made primarily from Cream City brick, which was sourced locally?
Yes, absolutely. So originally, when the field of architectural geology began back in the early 1800s, it was conceived of as being a part of economic geology, which is this field that involves quarrying stone and, of course, you know, fossil fuels and everything else. But you can tell a lot about what people were able to build with and how much they had to spend on it. For example, I'll give you one wonderful example. A lot of wonderful buildings in Milwaukee, of course, are made of Cream City brick. There's the Brown Double House, and there's the Matthew Keenan Townhouse, and the Pfister Hotel, and many very beautiful buildings. They used a higher grade of Cream City brick, which meant that they were spending more money. But if you wanted to be really showy and really show off how much money you were spending, you imported Philadelphia brick, okay, all the way from Philadelphia. And that's a very deep red brick. And you're really showing off that you have a lot of money to spend on your architectural project. And there's one very good example of that. Once again, right next to the Pfister Hotel, and that's the Milwaukee Club, which is one of my favorite buildings. It's just a beautiful building made of Philadelphia brick.
One thing I love about this book is its treatment of rocks and stones and inorganic matter as markers of history. And I think it's interesting when we typically are thinking of the history of Milwaukee, the story usually starts around 1846 when the city was officially established, or maybe sometime in the last few millennia when indigenous nations lived or migrated through here. But in this book, you ask readers to consider Milwaukee on a geological timescale, you know, stretching back millions of years to when the land that is now Milwaukee was actually located south of the equator and underwater, like just a very different experience than what we have today. And so I'm curious for you, as someone who's kind of thinking about geological timescales and time as, you know, in terms of millions of years, when you consider Milwaukee's history on a timescale of millions of years, what is revealed to you? What do you get from that kind of thinking and understanding of place?
A colossal sense of awe. when you realize, first of all, your true size, not only in the, you know, in the scope of the entire universe, but also in the scope of geologic time. It's a very humbling experience, but also it's a very exhilarating experience if you know how to handle it correctly. So, you know, our planet's history begins about 4.5 billion, a little bit more than 4.5 billion years ago. And the main bedrock that sits under Milwaukee, actually, there's some slightly younger bedrock up in the northern part of Milwaukee County, but it's about 425 million years old. And a lot of the buildings, including the Pfister Hotel, are clad in this wonderful stone. It's called the Wauwatosa Dolostone. That's the geological name for it. Actually, it's the Wauwatosa Limestone or Milwaukee County Limestone to everybody else. But anyway, this stone, you know, was actually formed when Milwaukee and the whole Midwestern region were part of a precursor continent called Laurentia that was situated about 30 degrees south of the equator. And we were covered by a shallow saltwater sea filled with coral reefs and all sorts of wonderful creatures. This is still about, well, roughly 200 million years before the real rise of the dinosaurs. So this is going back. But I can take you or anyone else to one of the great buildings. Once again, I keep mentioning Wisconsin Avenue in Milwaukee, but to the Wisconsin Gas Building, or to the what I still call the Warner Building, or over to the Wisconsin Tower. And the cladding or the stone that's used on the lower ground level part of that building is something called Morton Ice. That rock is 3.52 billion years old, or at least the oldest part of it. That is 3/4 the age of the solar system. And so I always tell my tour participants, put your hand on it, and that's the oldest earthly material you'll touch in your fleeting life. That's it right there.
Wow. Well, Ray, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect and for helping me think about time in the scale of millions of years and appreciating the fleeting moments that we have here together.
Sam, it's been a delight. Thank you very, very much.
Raymond Wiggers is a geologist and science writer who wrote the book Milwaukee in Stone and Clay, a guide to the Cream City's architectural geology. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods. Wiggers is a regular guest on our What Milwaukee is Made Of series. You can find those conversations at WUWM.com. After the break, we'll learn what Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail has to offer. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Love. Well, I've heard the word before. It's sleeping in my memory.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Pacific Crest Trail and the Appalachian Trail are popular places for hikers to challenge themselves. But Wisconsin also has a trail not too different from those busy and frequently visited ones. The Ice Age Trail is one of just 11 national scenic trails in the U.S., and it's all contained right here in Wisconsin. Thru-hiking the trail is becoming more and more popular, according to Melissa Pierick with the Ice Age Trail Alliance. She joins Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen to share more about the trail.
The trail is approximately 1,200 miles. It runs from St. Croix Falls all the way down as far as Janesville, where it's the southernmost point of the trail, up to Pottawatomie State Park in Sturgeon Bay. The route of the trail roughly follows where the last glacier ended. And so the trail is full of geological significance, and it takes you through so many great areas of the state. The path is very different from the North Woods down into the southern area, which is more urban, and then up into the Door County area. It's just, there's a lot of variety on the trail.
And the trail's been around since the 1950s. Can you talk a little bit about how the trail was established?
Sure. In the 1950s, Ray Zillmer first envisioned the idea of what was to become the Ice Age Trail. He was really enamored with the topography and the geology of the Northern Kettle Moraines. And he knew a lot about the glaciation that took place in the state at the time, though. He envisioned it as a national park, a 1,000-mile-long national park. Ultimately, the National Park Service decides, hey, they don't have an interest of having a national park that's that long. And unfortunately, Zillmer dies unexpectedly, and the efforts kind of die back for a few years until Congressman Henry Royce comes into play, and he kind of picks the idea back up of this national trail. And he really championed the idea of a trail through Wisconsin that would highlight the important glaciation that happened in our state. And so, through the course of many events and many years, the Ice Age Trail was formed in 1980.
What are some of the most popular stretches of the trail?
There are more than 100 segments of trail, and some of the most popular segments, you have the section that runs through Interstate State Park, which is beautiful, and that's where the western terminus of the trail is, and it looks out over the river, and it's gorgeous. You have the Dells of the Eau Claire, another spectacular and short segment. You have the great segments that go through Langlade, County, that are all run through county forest land. You have segments in Taylor County that run through the Shawinigan-Nicolet National Forest. Those segments really give you a Northwoods feel. People will see bears sometimes in those segments. Of course, Devil's Lake State Park, the trail runs around Devil's Lake. That's always a popular place. But one of the great things about the trail is that it takes you to these places that you probably would never otherwise visit. For example, Milton. I've lived in Wisconsin my whole life, and it wasn't until I started hiking the trail that I went to Milton. And the trail runs through many, many communities, including Milton, and it's lovely. You get to check out these small towns in Wisconsin and really get a feel for Wisconsin. You know, you have the Southern Kettle Moraines. The segments that run through the Southern Kettle Moraines are fun and hilly. The Northern Kettle Moraines, even more hilly. Oh, and then you go through the segment of Point Beach, and that's spectacular. You walk along the sand, you have the lake. I mean, it can also be miserable if you hit it when it's raining and cold. But I mean, there's just so many great places along the trail. And if you talk to hikers, everybody has a different favorite segment.
And as you said, this thing is like more than 1,000 miles long and doesn't just attract day hikers. People can backpack and through hike this trail. So what would that experience be like?
Well, I don't have firsthand knowledge because I am a segment hiker. And the majority of the people who hike the whole trail are segment hikers. So that just means they complete the trail by doing it one segment at a time. However, there has been a really nice increase in through hikers. And through hiking is a occupation for a lot of people, it turns out. And usually through hikers start with the Appalachian Trail, the Continental Divide Trail, the Pacific Crest Trail. Those are kind of the big three trails. But we've been getting more and more through hikers. And most of those hikers were coming off of different trails. And what was interesting was at the beginning of the season. So our through hiking season typically starts in about April. And we had like four or five hikers that had previously done the Appalachian Trail. And they thought, oh, 1,200 miles in Wisconsin, no problem. Well, a few of them abandoned because they did not like how lonely they were on the trail. When you hike through hike the Appalachian Trail, you are literally surrounded by 20, 30 people. So the people who came to the Ice Age Trail, you know, if they started in the Western Terminus, they would go days without seeing anybody. And that was hard for some people to handle. But other through hikers really enjoy the solitude of the trail. And, you know, they took that as the challenge. So we might not have, you know, the cliffs of the Continental Divide Trail or, you know, the rocks of the Appalachian Trail. But we do, the Ice Age Trail does have its own challenges, solitude being one of them.
You talked about kind of the small towns that the trail can bring people through. So what is an Ice Age Trail community?
So an Ice Age Trail community is a community that has decided that, yes, the trail is a benefit to them. And it's a cooperative agreement really between the Ice Age Trail Alliance and the Ice Age Trail community, where we promote the community and they promote the trail.
People might think they need to go to the Pacific Crest Trail, like you were mentioning, Melissa, to have a through hiking experience. But in fact, you don't even need to leave the state. So what do you think the Ice Age Trail brings to the people of Wisconsin?
Well, I think the Ice Age Trail is an absolute asset to the state. You know, a lot of people don't realize that it's a national scenic trail. And it's unfortunate because, you know, you hear a lot about the problems with the national parks or that you have to have reservations to get into the national parks, and oh, the national parks are so crowded. But the Ice Age Trail can provide a national park-like experience, you know, and within just a couple hours drive. And honestly, it's an amazing trail, and it's an amazing thing to explore. You know, it will take you to the most amazing places in the state, and they are places that I guarantee you did not know exist.
Melissa Pyrick is the Director of Marketing and Community Relations at Ice Age Trail Alliance. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen in 2023. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.